And we'll do the second half tonight. Okay, we'll do the other nine tonight. Welcome, Mr. Lacey. I didn't know you were here. He typed in the first text of the Aging Classics Theater of Life. Etc. Okay. Number 10. Say, Chong means like a village. Sok means etc. Jong means to destroy. The etc. stands for three other kinds of places. Chonghir, which means a city. Jong, which means a large area, like a county. And then Yul, which means a whole country. So there's really, how many root vowels here?
Four,
because there's four different objects. I hope somebody's keeping track. I don't even know how many.
23.
Okay. 27. All right. At the end, let me know. I'm curious. Okay. I never figured it out. there's really more than 18, right? So there's four vowels there. I was talking to Rinpoche last night, and we talked about this, and he said, the night before, and he said that a lot of the Bodhisattva vows, and especially the secret teachings, were designed for the busiest people of those times, because they needed something fast to collect virtue. And he said the people who were the most busy were the royalty and the great, the aristocrats of Indian society, the higher castes, especially kings and princes and things like that. A lot of the secret teachings were given to people who were actually in charge of countries. And this Bodhisattva vow is one of those that can be broken by a king or a minister of defense or something like that. I mean, mainly, you and I don't have normally the opportunity to destroy a whole village or a whole town or a whole county or a whole country. But that's what it refers to. It refers to destroying one of those habitations. I'm going to read directly from my notes. These are directly from Jetsun Kapa. I believe his analysis of the Bodhisattva vows is the best you can ever find. So it's nice to hear exactly what he said about each one. So I wrote down the main points. The motivation is important in each of these. In this motivation, the motivation is you want to destroy those places. Okay? That's not a surprise. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. And then he says Nyomong Chen. Nyomong Chen means a desire to destroy those places which is afflicted. One of the three mental, it's infected by desire, hatred, or ignorance. It has to be afflicted for you to break a root vow. Afflicted meaning it has to, your desire to destroy those places must be motivated by anger, by some variation of hatred, desire, or ignorance.
Did you say this is true of all the vows?
I would say so. Yeah. I'd say so. Jorwa means how do you actually undertake to destroy those places, and Jetsun Kapa lists a whole bunch of them. But he says it does not include striking the people in those places. Why? That's already been covered in Shakyang Mingyan. Okay, that's already been covered in that dual vow that started with someone apologizing to you. Actually, the other way around.
But with that vow, it had to be a grievous over time, right?
I mean, yeah.
And someone was wrong.
Yeah, whole long story. But he says, anyway, striking the people in those towns or cities is already covered, as is destroying the belongings of that place, which I guess would be, we could figure that out in the other class. I guess if there were temples there and things like that, it would be destroying the property of the Sangha. But it doesn't include those. And he doesn't say much more about it, except that it goes into, you know, normally kings and military officials of a country and things like that could do this one. I like those vows that we can't really break because we don't have the means at our disposal to break them. Yeah.
When this nuclear era, we could.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever became president and you had your finger on the bomb.
Or if you're flying.
Or if you're a terrorist.
Yeah.
Or if you're a GI in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You light up the book.
Yeah. Say Mahjong.
Mahjong.
Dong Yi Ten.
Dong Yi Ten.
Mahjong.
Mahjong.
Dong Yi Ten.
Dong Yi Ten.
always what in Tibetan?
Negative.
Either negative or feminine. This happens to be negative. Mahjong means not trained. Jung means trained. Dongyi means Dongbanyi. What's that?
Emptiness.
Shunyata. Okay, the idea of emptiness, the concept of emptiness. And then means to teach. So the vowel says to teach the idea of emptiness to those who are not trained, to those who are not well prepared. It's a very specific, like many of the Bodhisattva vows, and you will learn this when you go out in the world and you meet other Buddhists, American Buddhists, and you start comparing views about the Bodhisattva vows. You'll find out that they think it's wrong to teach emptiness to anyone who's not like totally into it and things like that. And you know, if you just read many of these vows, if you just read the name of the vow, you can get a misconception of what the vow is, and many American Buddhists never got past reading the names of the vows. They never got any actual description of the vows. This one is very, very specific. The tsatum, which means the point at which you break a root vow, is very specific, like in so many of these cases, like not giving material assistance to somebody. You have to have it, they have to want it, they have to approach you specifically, and then all those other conditions. This is similar. The following are the conditions. This is on your homework, okay? I think. They have not studied emptiness carefully. They haven't yet been able to study emptiness carefully. A. B is, by your description of emptiness, they would become frightened. C, very important, they already have the wish for Buddhahood. They already have bodhicitta in some form. Okay, obviously not the real thing, which is very difficult, but they already have the intention to try to reach Buddhahood for all sentient beings. They're already on the bodhisattva ideal. It does not have to be the full form of bodhicitta, which is almost impossible to...
Are you saying you shouldn't teach them emptiness if they...
We didn't get to the punchline yet. I'm still describing the qualities of the person to whom you should not teach emptiness.
And they have bodhicitta.
They have the wish.
They must have the wish to achieve enlightenment for all sentient beings in some form, okay? It doesn't have to be complete, total...
You shouldn't teach somebody with that.
Yeah, but you'll see why in a few seconds, okay?
Did you say that they already...
They already have it. They must already have some kind of intention to reach Buddhahood for all sentient beings. This is the condition. They have to be like that. The person must be like that. Why, we'll get to later in a few seconds. Okay? Jetsu Kapa takes the time to identify what you're teaching them. Tripitam Chedun Dori Tongyi. Tripitam Chedun Dori Tongyi means emptiness, which is free of all elaboration, you could say, or projection. Anyways, pure emptiness, total emptiness. You're teaching them the ultimate meaning of emptiness. There are different kinds of teachings on emptiness. You are teaching them the meaning of pure emptiness. We can call it pure emptiness. Then there's a very important part in Jetsun Kapa's text. He says, what must occur with that person for you to break the vow is the following. They must become afraid and turn away from the Mahayana, give up the Mahayana, and embrace the Hinayana.
Sorry, did you list all five already? You said there are five characteristics.
I didn't say five.
How many are
there?
I don't even know. I didn't say it. Okay. I didn't say there'd be a number. Not very galupa, right? Anyway, this is what has to happen. You teach them emptiness. They get scared. They are already Mahayana people. They give up Mahayana and they decide to go for Hinayana. Exclusively. Jetsun Kapa says one more thing about it. He says, you have to realize again that the Bodhisattva vows are spread out through all these ancient scriptures. They were collected together at different periods in time. And Jetsun Kapa is struggling to, as he did his whole life, to clean up the whole thing and figure it out decisively. And he says, I checked all the scriptures available to me. And it seems like if you check the person to see if they have studied enough, And if in your best judgment they have studied enough, and then you teach them emptiness, and then they get scared and turn to the Hinayana, you have not committed a sati. Okay? If you have used your best judgment to check the person first, and you happen to be wrong, you don't collect a root breaking into that. Yeah?
But emptiness is a quality of Hinayana as well.
They call it selflessness, and it has a different interpretation in the Hinayana. So we're talking about, that's why we said ultimate, the high, the pure meaning of emptiness, the one which would most likely frighten someone. So now you've got the whole thing. So, you know, I know that I've met Americans who are telling me, oh, you have to be really careful about teaching people emptiness because you'll break your bodhisattva vows. Some people think that if you teach anybody emptiness, you break your bodhisattva vows. And other people think that if you teach emptiness to people who haven't had much Buddhism, you break your bodhisattva vows. Now you see the condition under which you break your bodhisattva vows. Obviously, if you teach someone emptiness who's not prepared and who doesn't, never heard of Mahayana or Hinayana, and if it freaks them out or if it turns them off, that's very bad. And it's probably a very serious bad deed. Secondly, it's obviously, to me, I mean, it's probably one of the worst sins you can commit to teach somebody an idea about emptiness that you cooked up and you don't know anything about it, and it's something weird, and the Buddha never said it, and you see that all over the place. You see it all over. And hopefully by the end of these courses, you'll be able to just walk up to that person and say, let's debate. You know, show me the Buddha ever said that. You know, you're totally mistaken. This is crazy, and you're hurting all these people. You're teaching them something very strange, and that's not what emptiness means at all. Probably if they're not mentioning morality in immediate conjunction with emptiness, then there's something weird going on. You know, they are brothers and sisters, and they have to come together. And probably if they're not teaching karma, immediately in conjunction with teaching emptiness, there's something weird going on. Some kind of incomplete idea about emptiness, or wrong. That's another possibility. But that's not breaking your root vow. To break the root vow, they must be Mahayana already. They give up Mahayana and they embrace the man. Yeah.
I assume this only covers one-to-one personal teaching and not publishing or any other form of teaching.
He doesn't say that, but I'd say seems to me if you published it, it would be similar. I don't know.
But you have no way of checking the reader.
I know.
So
maybe that's am I supposed to move? Okay. Hey, I get out of this one. Oh, that's repetitive. Okay. I know, like in tantric subjects, if you publish it, it's you break your vows. But I mean, if you allow, if you publish it knowing that people have not had initiations and can read it, you break your vows. So I don't know, you know, I'll ask you. Okay, so that's Mahjong Toni Hen. Although I should say about that, you know, the Tibetan tantric scriptures on the cover of the book often say, if you haven't had an initiation, you cannot read this book. Which implies that the publishers knew that somebody would try. And I think if you put that warning on the front, and someone still does it, then maybe you don't break it down. I don't know if somebody just put in this one. Because you've tried, but it seems to me difficult to say that. It's very bad if it happens. And it probably will happen if you print a book for public distribution, and you know it's probably going to happen. Say, Dzogchang Do.
Dzogchang Do.
Dzogchang Do.
Dzogchang Do.
Dzogchang means Samyak Sambuddha. It means total Buddhahood, total enlightenment. I always used to wonder why they say total. Why do you think? I mean, enlightenment's enlightenment. You know? Can you have a half enlightenment? Nirvana is enlightenment?
Not total enlightenment.
Yeah, the two Hinayana Nirvana are sometimes called Buddha, are sometimes given that name. So we have to put the adjective total, meaning the Buddhahood which you get if you practice Mahayana, you go all the way to total enlightenment. Dog means to turn someone back. And again, Jetsu Kapa analyzes it. The person whom you turn back must be a person who does have the wish for enlightenment. Okay? Maybe not in its total form. Probably not in its total form. They do have some intention to achieve enlightenment for all sentient beings. They have entered the Mahayana teachings, the Mahayana way. And the way you turn them back is very specific, and I'll just quote directly from Joseph Pup. It says, you could never follow the six perfections, so you should go instead, you should make your goal instead one of the nirvanas of the Hinayana teachings. And then you'll be freed from samsara. You'll be free from suffering. And Jetsun Kaba says, in his best understanding of it, which means he's kind of allowing for the opposite, okay? The person, to break the root vow, the person actually has to give up Mahayana. Okay, not only do you attempt to dissuade them, but you succeed and they give it up. They turn away from Mahayana.
So then again, they can't practice the six perfections, and so what should they
say? Like, look, the six perfections. How is John Stillwell ever going to reach into his eye socket and rip out his eyeball and hand it to that guy standing at the front of the subway entrance if he asks for it? Which is what exactly what Nagarjuna did, more or less. I mean, how could you ever do that? Just give it up, man. Get out of suffering, follow the Hinayana path, perceive emptiness, perceive the Four Noble Truths, and you can get to Nirvana, relatively speaking, much more quickly, much easier. You could never go through all those bodhisattva practices. Give it up. And then if the person actually does, you commit a root. You break a root vow.
So do you have to specifically say you can't do the six perfections?
I mean, no, you could say the five or the four.
Like, well, no, I mean, you could just say, like, well, it's too hard.
It's like saying, describing to them how hard it's going to be, how long it's going to take, and they give up. It does not have to be all six perfections.
You just tell them it's too hard, don't do it.
Yeah, bodhisattva activities are beyond you. You will never get there. You might as well just go for it.
Is it equally bad if they
Probably worse, I would say. But this is, I'm not... This is the classic form of the root. That would be Chukong or something like that. You see what I mean? I'm not sure which root that would come under. But that would probably come under. Yeah.
And so this is somebody who actually was capable of...
Everyone
filling
is.
...filling this.
Bodhicharmatara says, Dhammu Shadan Nekyang Mi. It means, in the chapter on effort, it says, if bugs and flies and worms can achieve total enlightenment, then I guess I can too if I try. Yeah.
Is there motivation on this?
Doesn't say. He may say, I didn't put it in my notes. After the first four, it doesn't always mention the motivation, but it, normally it would have to be one of the three poisons.
A lot of these questions refer to Vinayana. If one, like in this one, if you dissuade the person from any kind of Buddhist thought at all, you have to say everything is nonsense. But
it's being covered. The bad deed is when they give up the Mahayana. It's not that they have to turn to something else. You've described how easy it would be to follow Hinayana, but the bad deed is when they turn away from Mahayana and not necessarily embrace Hinayana in this case. So if you dissuade them from all Buddhism, you've covered the Mahayana also.
That's then a backup against the vow of not believing that somebody can reach enlightenment. Isn't it like a duplication? Once you take that vow, doesn't it cover all of that?
You mean the wrong view vow, where you say it's impossible to reach enlightenment?
Right. Doesn't it include you could never tell anyone, one would never know. If someone
Jetsun Kapa loves these kind of questions. I bet he would say, the Lopta is your thinking, that thought. Your thinking, it's impossible for a human being to become perfected, which many Christians think, okay? That's a very... We were talked into that when we were kids. You could, like, be real good and reach heaven, but you could never become perfect.
Jesus never said it, though.
Well, I know. But that's the thought occurring in your own mind without saying anything. This is a result of a verbal deed. You talk the person out of it, they decide not to do it, and then they turn away from it. So that's two different things. But they're very common. There's a lot of overlap when we get into the secondary vows. Jetsun Kapa spends a whole section on explaining why they're different. So it's a good question. It's going to come a lot more when we hit the 46 secondary vows, which I like, because I always used to wonder why they kept repeating them.
Even.
Okay. Say sotarpong.
Sotarpong.
What is sosotarpa? Do you know? Pratimoksha. What is pratimoksha?
Freedom vows. Freedom vows.
Yeah, the freedom vows, meaning 7 or 8 types.
Right.
Called individual freedom vows because if you keep them yourself, you will get free. And if somebody else does not keep them themselves, they will not get free. So it's really an individual thing. Mm-hmm. It's a personal thing. It's basically vowed morality, either of a layman or of an ordained person. 3 kinds of layman's vows and 5 kinds of ordained person's vows. Sota bong. Bong means you get someone to give it up. You convince someone to give up the pratimoksha morality.
This doesn't apply to you then.
No. It's interesting, see? You gotta learn all these things. I never knew them. How can we be keeping them? We're supposed to tunduking. We're supposed to be tunduking. You're supposed to be covering these 6 times a day and checking yourself if you have any of these. So you don't die with one on your conscience. Who is it that gives up the pratimoksha, he says? It's a person who is keeping the pratimoksha properly. This person is normally an ordained person. They're keeping the pratimoksha quite well. You know, they're happy with the pratimoksha, they're practicing it, they're keeping it. Doesn't have to be an ordained person if it's a pratimoksha. It could be a layman also. But they are keeping their lifetime vows nicely.
And you have to know that.
That normally to commit a real leki lam, a totally bad deed, okay, in every respect, totally complete in every respect, you have to have what's called recognition. You know, you have to realize that so that they are what they are to commit the bad deed. So I would say probably yes, but he doesn't cover it specifically. The way in which you do it is very specific. You tell them, and by the way, what I'm about to say is a wrong idea, okay? It's not the truth, all right? You tell them, why follow the pratimoksha? Come over to Mahayana instead, and by having bodhicitta, and by studying the Mahayana, you will thereby be able to eliminate all your bad deeds. You don't need pratimoksha. Come over to Mahayana and
you don't need those.
Give up this. It's a common idea, you know. Why do you have to keep your monks? Why do you still have to be a monk if you can take bodhisattva vows? And you know the answer. It's best to be a monk and keep bodhisattva. And that's the best combination. So this person is obviously not understanding that keeping your normal morality is the basis of keeping your bodhisattva vows.
So if you just say to someone, what a pain in the butt, you know, why are you doing all that? Drink some wine and it doesn't count.
Let me think about it. What did it have to be?
You have to have them come over to my honor, not just discouraging them from making effort and working hard.
Right. But I don't know. I wouldn't want to take a chance.
just according to this, though, it's, you know.
Technically. I don't know. I don't want to say, okay? I wouldn't... I'd say we have to avoid the whole thing. All right, so that's sotarpong. You guys are sleeping. No one argued me or anything. I don't know. Say nyenme.
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 Okay, nyen stands for nyente de rangyavitekwa, which means the 2 Hinayana tracks. One is called the listener track, and one is called the self-made Buddha track. There's 2 Hinayana tracks. And the word nyen stands here for both of them. Listener track in Hinayana, the typical teaching there is on the 4 Noble Truths. Truth of suffering, truth of the cause of suffering. Presented in a Hinayana, with a Hinayana motivation, in a Hinayana way. The self-made Buddha path track is neither, those people are neither self-made nor Buddhist, but we call them self-made Buddhists. Okay? They're self-made in the sense that in this life they didn't have a teacher. But they had thousands and thousands of teachers in their past life. So it looks like they didn't have a teacher in this life, but they did. And then Buddha means they're looking to reach a lower enlightenment, nirvana. Just nirvana.
Do you speak?
Anyway, those nyen here, the word nyen here means lower, it means Hinayana track, one of those two Hinayana tracks. You're reaching, you're striving for good, you're striving to end your own suffering. And you're not doing so to help all other living beings. That's Hinayana track. Me literally means to put it down, to disparage it, to talk bad about it.
So can you keep Hinayana again?
Basically, it's working to get rid of your own personal suffering and not doing so because you want to help all other living beings. And the bad deed here, the root, when you break your root vow, it's because you say the following about that Hinayana track. You say, no matter how much you study those Hinayana teachings, you cannot remove your mental afflictions in their entirety. You can't reach Nirvana. And that's not true, okay? It is not true. You can't. You don't have to enter the Mahayana teachings to end your own suffering, and you don't have to enter the Mahayana teachings to remove your own mental afflictions permanently. You can reach Nirvana through a study of the through practicing the Hinayana paths. You can. So you break this vow when you say to somebody, "You can't. It's impossible."
It's not something that occurs. When you say it?
Normally it occurs when they grasp what you have said. Let's see if he says you have to give it up. No, it's just that when he understands what you said.
Without accepting it, just grasping it?
Yeah, normally it's when they... Kor chawam is when they get what you said. What it means is if you tell it to a child, if you told it to Bodhi, you don't break a root vow. If she doesn't grasp what you're talking about. She never heard of Hinayana, or if you tell it to Rusty the dog, you do not break a root vow. It's normally these vows of speech are broken when the other person grasps what you're trying to say.
You use the word enlightenment.
Excuse me?
You can't reach Nirvana. What did you say? Can't reach enlightenment.
He just says.
Well, it would be accurate, isn't it?
It is accurate. That would be accurate. If you're referring to Buddhahood itself. Okay. This is very, very common, and we have to be very careful. And we are Mahayana Buddhists. We're studying Tibetan Buddhism. We're studying Bodhisattva ideal. And it's very common to hear people put down Hinayana teachings like Sri Lanka or Thailand and say that they're dumb or they don't know what they're doing. That's very common to hear that. But you should know that in Tibet, they study the Hinayana teachings, I believe, more deeply than they do in any other country. We spent 10 years on the Abhidhamma. It was the first thing we did in the monastery. We study it, we enjoy it, we get a lot out of it. It is spoken by the Buddha. It is the Buddha's teaching. It's meant as a tool to get you up higher. And it's beautiful. Teachings are very, very... The people who took the Karma course know that. They did a good dose of Abhidhamma. And all the monks' vows, all the teachings on Vinaya, they all come from Hinayana. As practiced in Tibet, everything is Hinayana. So it's very beautiful, very wonderful. And it's very stupid to put it down. It means you haven't studied it, basically. If you studied it, you would appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question. I don't think there's no such thing as total Buddha. I mean, there is like a high level, but you always have room to progress.
No,
but there's always room.
There's a level you reach where that's it.
Oh, there's
totally
perfect.
Okay. Yeah.
And what's the difference between Mahayana?
We had that debate in the monastery.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I remember this debate. Because somebody said, I was saying, you could make it, you could always be more perfect because you could be a Buddha longer. You know, like, isn't it better to be a Buddha, have been a Buddha for 2 years than to have been a Buddha for 1 year? Isn't it twice as good in a way? We had this horrible debate all night one time. And I don't know. We didn't decide much, but the teacher said, he said, no, it's perfect from the first moment. I mean, you can't get more enlightened than that. You're perfect. It's very interesting when you see emptiness directly for the first time at the path of seeing. You never see it more perfectly than that. I mean, you either see emptiness directly or you don't.
Can I say something? When you see emptiness?
When you see it directly, it's not like you improve on it, you know. That's not like 20 years later when you see it again, that seeing is better than when the first time you saw it. It's just a pure, total perception of emptiness. And a Buddha has extra qualities going on while he sees it, but his perception of emptiness directly is in a way as pure. Your first one is as pure as his, or hers.
So when you reach emptiness, how do you know when you reach emptiness if you're not thinking? Supposedly you're not supposed
perceive
to
perceive it directly?
Yeah.
While you're perceiving,
how do you know what's
it,
going
you
on
don't
if
know
you're, not?
You're perceiving it. And
so you just like merge
after you finish, you.
Oh, that's when you start.
You realize that you do. Okay. You missed that class. That was the most fun. Okay. We'll do one more and then we'll take a break. There's a missing vowel. That's cool, huh?
Wow.
Yeah. We can call it 14B. How about 14 and a half? That's easy. Seriously. It's a vowel in between 14 and 15.
Missing the short form, not normally in the list.
It is missing in the list. They always count 18. You never see 19. There is really 19 even before you break them out. I'm about to tell you. Dr. Shinma, sound familiar?
No.
What's Dr. Shinma?
Praising yourself.
Praising yourself and putting down others.
Sounds familiar.
No objections?
Yeah, no, we had it already.
Yeah, we already had that one. That's why Shantideva left it out. Okay. Remember, these are coming from two different sources. The first four came from where?
Maitreya
Sangha. And then the other 14 came from?
Various places.
13 from one sutra, one from another sutra. Okay. But when Shantideva, when he gets up to his time, he says, we don't have to count this one because it's the same as Asanga's first one. So we don't have to mention it. It was actually a separate, it was found in the sutras also. So when Geshe Tsewang Sandru, the 10th Dalai Lama's teacher, writes his text, he actually describes the whole vow. But the interesting thing is that there's more detail about the vow. So that's why it's good to know. And I'll tell you the detail. It's still for the same reasons. What were the reasons? Why did you praise yourself and put down other people?
Fame and gain.
You either want material gain, or you want fame. Other people's admiration. Okay. It's very specific here. It says, you have to be a person who's reciting Mahayana texts, who's studying Mahayana texts, who's teaching Mahayana texts. And you have to go around saying, I'm a bodhisattva. I'm doing all this with no regard to material gain or fame. But that guy over there, who says he's a bodhisattva, is doing it for money or fame. That's the whole context in which you break the vow. It's really accusing another person of teaching or studying or reciting Mahayana teachings for their own gain, for bad reasons.
This is to prevent like schism.
Well, it's very natural to think that, and that's what I wanted to say next, like a schism, to create a split among Buddhists. Is pretty much the most serious bad deed you can do. We studied that in the Karma course. This would be like the classic way that it happens. And you can see, you can hear me do it sometimes. You have to stop me. That's another thing about bodhisattva vows. You know. The nice thing about learning it in a big group is that we can help each other. You know. If you hear me start to do it, you have to say, hey, bodhisattva vows, man. No, that's a great benefit of having a lot of Dharma friends. When we're around each other, we can control each other and say, you know, you're not supposed to do that. Why are you doing
just
that?
That's a bodhisattva.
So that's the classic way in which it takes place.
But what
you have to have the wrong view in the wrong way.
What wrong view?
I mean, that this person is teaching the wrong teachings when they were actually teaching, right?
It's not accusing him of teaching the wrong teachings. It's saying he's doing it out of a desire for gain or fame.
When
and
he really
I'm not.
Doesn't.
He's not a real bodhisattva. There's a long debate about whether or not it's a lie or not.
Does it matter if it's a lie?
Jetsun Gamba finally says it seems to be a according to most texts, which doesn't nail it down, right, that it should be a lie. But that seems to leave it open for it not being a lie.
So if your motivation is that kind of motivation...
Here's the motivation coming here. Motivation must be jealousy for the honor or gain that other people are getting. Motivation is jealousy. Now I'll tell you one more thing, okay? Very interesting. Jetsu Kappa at this point says, Master Shantideva chose not to list this as a separate vow. And Master Shantideva said that he didn't do that because this one was completely equal to the first one. So Jetsu Kappa says, that probably implies that to break the first one, there has to be these circumstances going on. You're jealous of somebody else's, getting attention or honor of people, and you attack them, and you say that they're just fake bodhisattvas, and you're the real bodhisattva. He says, but he doesn't say it's definitive, okay? So we have to be careful of all the forms of... He says, probably. He says, probably, given that Shantideva didn't make it a separate vow, and said that it was equal to the first vow, then Asanga's first vow probably involves all of this context where you're accusing someone else of being after money or fame, and teaching for that, or studying for that.
Yeah. So then you're breaking three vows at one time?
How so?
Well, number one is two vows, raising yourself and living others.
He kind of says that... Let's say you praise yourself and put down another person for these motivations, you would break number one. And number 14 and a half is the same as number one, so I don't think you don't break twice. You don't break two. Because Master Shantideva he left it out because he says it's the same thing.
So it doesn't count.
It's not a separate vow.
And who said this about what Shantideva?
Excuse me?
Who said this about Shantideva?
Oh, Jetsu Kappa is describing how Shantideva said, since this vow is pretty much equal to the first vow, we don't have to make it a separate number. And since Shantideva describes the vow as being a Mahayana person who puts down another Mahayana person, it must mean, says Jetsu Kappa, that the first vow also entails that same thing. In other words, I know that when I was first took these vows many years ago, I had this fuzzy understanding of them. And I thought that if I ever said anything bad about someone else, I broke my bodhisattva vows. It's not like that. These have to be pretty much evil things, because they wipe out your chances to reach the first bodhisattva bhumi in this life when you do one. So they have to be, they have to be like destroying a city or spitting in the face of someone who literally comes to you as their last desperate hope to save their life, and you say, no. It has to be, these are pretty serious. Talking somebody out of practicing Mahayana, that's very serious. It has to be pretty, as you study them more and more deeply, you begin to see that it's not just the things that you thought when you first heard that, you saw them listed in a book, you know. It's not just teaching emptiness to somebody who's not quite ready. It's getting them to a point where they give up Mahayana because you gave them a bad explanation and freaked them out. And they give it all up. That's a much different thing. So you start to get this feeling of how they're really violent and evil and specific, you know. Of course, the other things, you know, the other variations where you're at work and you praise yourself and put someone else down, that's very serious. But it's not breaking your bodhisattva root vows, which are so serious that you cannot achieve the first bhumi in this life. According to Jetsu Kappa. Yeah? We didn't get there yet. That's 15.
Oh,
that's after the break.
So you're referring to something that's not written.
Right. It's not in the list. Two more questions, then we got to take a break.
The example you just gave of putting someone down at work, I mean, the definition you gave is putting them down for the respect or admiration of others, and that breaks your vow.
And now Jetsu Kappa says it looks like it's more specific than that.
Oh, I see. Come on.
And that's why I've been waiting until I got here. He says, according to how Shantideva explains it, it looks like, and it makes sense, that it should be as serious as attacking another Dharma teacher in New York and saying that this person's out for money and I'm not.
Is it only that first vow then that's Mahayana to Mahayana? I mean, it wasn't clear last week whether it's
What did he say? Yeah, he clearly says Mahayana a couple times.
First vow.
Well,
the other vows also.
when he gets number one, right?
Yeah. Only that.
According to what he says, looks like that.
Well, would that be breaking the vows if that was true?
He says, looks like it has to be a lie.
But
if it were
true,
but I'll tell you, to confirm it would almost take the ability to read the other person's mind, wouldn't it? I mean, we have to be really careful.
Or your understanding of the Dharma, depending on what you're teaching.
Yeah. But remember, you have to be accusing that person of teaching for the purpose of gain, personal gain. And you know, it's very typical that a Dharma teacher can collect a massive, huge wealth, ride around in Mercedes, and not have that motivation at all. It's quite possible. You have to be really careful. Better to just leave it alone. That's the point. Because there could be a high bodhisattva who's doing it for some specific reason. Just, we gave the example in the logic class we had. We heard about some poor soul who accused a bodhisattva of going to the town out of some kind of desire, and as a result took hundreds and hundreds of births, horrible births, and when he was finally reached the enlightenment, and when he was called Shakyamuni Buddha, said, be careful about that, you know, I wasted thousands of very famous. We use it to open a lot of debates. Don't judge other people. Just leave it. Could be really wrong. Robert, and then we got to take a break.
It seems like for us Westerners, it's pretty popular for us to call other people hypocrites. You know, especially in a religious sense. Yeah. It seems like this is specifically geared to the motivation where you are jealous.
Yeah.
Okay, that's
yeah. There
that's
does have to be this motivation. If you're jealous of, they're starting to attract followers, they're starting to attract people, and you don't like it.
You lust it.
And you start to criticize them. Okay, we'll take a break. Come back in 10 minutes. We'll make it on time. We'll do it pretty good.
Satsuma.
I think we're gonna wait. This one's.
Satsu Ma or Satsu Ma?
Python, Ma.
Ma.
Ma means mother. Ma means talk. Ma. Ma. Ma.
Ma.
Ma.
Ma.
Ma.
Ma.
So means
ma.
We were talking about the Lama who passed away, and we were recalling which class we ever took with him, and they screened the candidates for the class. The Lama wanted everybody to get in, and the administrators of the place didn't want everybody to get in. So he was in charge of administering the exam, you know. And I had just gotten it the day before or something, you know. And I really wanted to take the class. So he says to me, what does ma mean in Tibetan? Okay, sub-dhimma. Sub stands for sub-mo. Sub-mo means profound or deep. It's always a code word for the teachings on
emptiness.
Okay. Here it refers to emptiness. Dzin means a lie, falsehood, to speak a lie. Ma means to say. So it means to say a lie about the profound. What does that mean? And I'll read you straight from Desen Kha. First of all, there must be another person, and he must grasp what you're saying. Okay, that's the context. There must be another person there, and you're telling him or her about something. And when he or she grasps it, you've committed the breaking of your root vow. And the way in which you the lie you say is as follows. See, I'm teaching you emptiness. I've seen it directly. I love you, so I'm teaching you about it. You will see it directly. You will be able to do just what I did, if it's not true. But as a lie, to say, basically, the circumstances are this. I've seen emptiness directly. I like you, so I'm teaching you emptiness. And if you do just what I say, you'll see emptiness directly, too. And it's all a lie. The person has not seen emptiness directly.
to do all components.
It's like those diamond dealers, you know. Michael, it's only because I like you that I'm giving you this diamond. You're not making any money at all.
Trust me.
I'm
tired of it. Does that incorporate self-delusion?
Let's skip
it. Oh, does he think he's seen it?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to be that way, but could be.
Would that also involve a direct perceptual understanding or just direct perception?
He's talking directly.
Does this aspect of liking the person have to be there? Or you could just say, look, I've seen emptiness, you do what I say, you can see it.
He's saying he likes it.
I know, but is that necessary to
bring it about? He mentions it, but I don't believe it's necessary. I don't believe it has to be part of the lie. I want to help you, so... You know, I don't believe that has to be part of the lie. He's just saying, I've seen emptiness directly, you do what I say, you'll see it directly. Okay, not when he says it, when the other person grasps the meanings of the word. The meaning of the words. He says, by the way, if you're a monk, he left because he got confused about the schedule. He already took his class. But let's say that, I mean, I would have asked him the question, but that's one of our four Pamba. Pamba means one of our four most serious bad deeds, is to lie about our spiritual level. And so when a monk who's taken his bodhisattva vows does this one, he collects a root, he breaks a very, very root vow of a monk's vows, and then he breaks his root vow of his bodhisattva vows. The monk collects really two root vows in two different systems, breaking root vows at the same time.
What if the person actually has seen emptiness, but is just giving bad advice?
If they've seen emptiness directly, it'd be very unlikely that they'd give anybody bad advice.
That would make it worse.
Almost totally, almost impossible.
Because if they've
almost impossible.
If they've seen it, they by definition don't. They claim. I mean, they do not say that they've seen it because they're no longer a Buddhist.
It would be extremely rare for a person to outright say that they have seen it. It's part of the experience. He says he makes a point. That is not very important, but we have time. It has to be for any reason except jealousy. It's a lie, right? Saying, I saw emptiness directly because you're jealous of somebody else.
I'm sorry.
Isn't it so that if you say, I have seen emptiness
directly,
that means by using the words that way, you are separated from it, you have seen it?
During the direct perception of emptiness.
Excuse me?
During the direct perception of emptiness. Subject and object are indivisible in the sense that you can't perceive a relative object. But it doesn't mean in any way that you become one with that object. And that's a common misperception. And that we had that in the last class. It should have been. I'm kidding.
I'm thinking about Rashid.
Yeah, it's the words are indivisible and people get confused. Non-duality, people get confused by those words. They don't mean that.
But what if we lie about the
profound note of jealousy? Then it's, I believe, Dr. Schindler. I think that's what he's trying to say.
But you're not criticizing yourself. You're not criticizing yourself.
You don't have to be doing both, remember?
Oh, it's one of the...
Cheryl, did you have something? No. Okay, forgot it. Good. All right. Say Choksum.
Choksum.
Korlen.
Korlen.
Choksum.
Choksum.
Korlen.
Korlen.
Choksum stands for Korjoksum. What's that?
Three jewels.
Three jewels. Three ratnas. Buddha Dharma Sangha. Choksum. Kor we've had before up above. We had Korchok, Korchok, Korchok. Kor means to be anything that belongs to the three jewels. Which basically means anything that's been dedicated to spiritual use of a center or a temple or a monastery or a group of practitioners or any kind of food, money, house, books, images, anything that in that sense belongs to the three jewels. We have Koinchok Kortog, which means to steal the belongings of the three jewels. But this one is to lend. Lend means to accept. A-C-C-E-P-T. To accept it.
Accepting stolen goods.
Yeah, it's accepting stolen goods. And it happens like this. He said, Jesakaba says, normally the scenario is like this. But it doesn't have to be like this. The officials of the country decide that they like one monastery and they don't like the other monastery. And this happens in countries like Thailand, Sri Lanka. I'm not saying they're bad people there, but I mean, in countries where you have thousands of monasteries, you can have this kind of thing happening, where they actually force one monastery. They put a punishment or a tax on this monastery and say, oh, you had a bad monk, you have to give us $1,000. And they take that money and they give it to the monastery they like. When the people in the second monastery take it, then that's going to form that accepting stolen Dharma goods. Okay?
You have to know it's stolen.
Normally, you do. Somebody asked me about that because, like, all these tankas floating around Hong Kong that were stolen from Tibetan monasteries and stuff. Mm-hmm. Normally, to commit a totally bad deed, you have to recognize the object as having been stolen. Normally. What else does he say? That's all. He also says you don't have to steal it with your own hands. If you send your men to go steal it for you.
This is not receiving it. This is not stealing it. I thought you said this is receiving it.
Oh, I'm sorry. He says stealing. He's referring back to the other one. When I said stealing, it can be... Well, also in this one, if you're like the king and you send someone to... No, you still... You would do the... You would be the stealing. Same thing. Okay. Number 17. Say, Qingyan.
Qingyan.
Cha.
Cha.
Qingyan.
Qingyan.
Cha.
Cha.
This Qin is the Qin in Sub-Qin. This Qin means law or rule. A Qin building is a courthouse. A Qin general is a judge. A Qin cutter is a lawyer. Meaning a person who cuts the fine points in a court case. That's a Qin chakin. So Qin means rule or law. Nian means bad. Bad. Like Dong Yema means bad face, and it's something you say when you want to start a fight. I don't know what you call that.
Provocation.
You're a Nian face, you know. So Nian means bad, ugly. Cha means to institute. So it means to institute a bad rule. Excuse me? Cha means to start a bad rule, to make a bad rule, and it's very specific. The people that you make the rule about must be Dharma practitioners. You're making a rule that's going to apply to Dharma practitioners. And what this refers to is that in a monastery, for example, or even in a Dharma group, you'll have certain people who are attracted to the meditative side of things. They're more attracted to spending a lot of time in meditation. They like to do long retreats at the expense of the study side. Then you have other people who are really attracted to the study side. They spend a lot of time with the books. They recite everything. They memorize everything. And if you walked into a monastery, and I've seen it in Sarah, and it happened in ancient times, Shantideva was accused of this. You could get the wrong idea that the meditators are lazy. And the people who can recite everything and explain everything and read everything, and they seem to be somehow working harder. So this is, you commit this bad deed when you go to the rooms of the meditators and you take away their possessions, and you reward the people who apparently working harder, studying harder, you know, they're working on the knowledge side, more the physical knowledge side. They're both good. Both groups are great. We would like to be both. You have to be both. That's one of the hopes for the place in Connecticut. We could have a place to meditate, because we're deficient in that in this group. We don't have a place. But the point is, you have to respect both sides. You can't think or assume that a person who's spending a lot of time in meditation and can't recite all the texts and all that is not making good progress. And you have to respect them. And this is the opposite. This is where you actually go and take away their things and hand them over to the people who are apparently making good progress. You have to be careful about that idea. The classic example was in ancient India, Master Shantideva. They called him Dushi Sambhava. Mr. Robert, what's that? Yeah, he was like Mr. Three Thoughts. They gave him a nickname, Mr. Three Thoughts, because he just hanged out in his room all the time. One was eating, sleeping, and pooping. They called him, Shantideva was accused by all the monks in the monastery, most of them, of having only three concerns on his mind all the time. And to get rid of him, they decided they would ask him to give up the monthly lecture or something in the Dharma Hall, and he would make such a fool of himself that they could ask him to leave the monastery. So he accepted the invitation. To make sure he looked stupid, they made a real high throne and didn't put any stairs to get up on it. So he would stand there and try to climb up on it or something. And they say he walked into the Dharma Hall, all the monks were assembled, and there was this blur, and then he was up on top, sitting quite nicely. He started to teach the Bodhicitta, the Bodhisattva's way of life, guided Bodhisattva's way of life. And people were, astounded, because that's probably, it's one of the top 10 Dharma teachings ever given, right? And people couldn't believe it. And then he got to the ninth chapter, which is the perfection of wisdom. And he got so profound that he started to levitate off the throne. And so there are a few monks in the audience who had the ability, and they would start to levitate too to keep up with it. Nobody could follow him at that. And still people write separate commentaries on the ninth chapter. And then he never came back to the monastery, and they had to go looking for him. And they found him in a cave, and they said, please come back. He said, I don't think so. And then they said, could you at least give us the manuscript to this teaching? And he said, it's in the rafters of my room. You can find it there. Don't call people Mr. Three Thoughts. So what it means is, you can't disrespect the meditation. And this one is when you actually take their goods. The people accepting the goods don't break the root bell. It's not their fault. They didn't initiate the action. It wasn't their idea. It might be Kwanjo Koto, land. Anyway, it's the people who took the things. He says, can't refer to taking the possessions of an Arya, who has seen emptiness directly. Doesn't refer to taking the possessions of four monks or more, because those are what? Those are the three ratnas. Those are the coin chokes. Then it's stealing the property of the Dharma, Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
So is he trying to say that ordained people aren't part of one of the three jewels? Is that what he's saying?
No, they're not. Four or more is Genjin.
Yeah, no, but Sangha. Individually, I'm talking about.
Individually, it's apparently not, but anyway, I don't want to get too deep. Who says the thing has to be anything which they enjoy the use of, anything they own. The motivation has to be some kind of anger or hatred for them, some kind of dislike for them. That's interesting. And then he repeats that it's not, the bad deed is not committed by the people to whom the things are given. The scholarly types. It's not them collecting the bad deed, it's the one who takes it away from the man, who had the idea to take it away. Okay.
Is this once again?
This is all pretty much, I think you'd have to be the abbot of a monastery. But you could see, when you check yourself for these vows 6 times a day, which is a long time in the bathroom, okay? People have to think you have a disease or something. You're normally checking for how close you came. Is it in your mind that you don't respect meditators as much as the people who get up and teach these Dhamma courses? Is that in your back of your mind? And things like that. You have to search yourself for those attitudes that could ever lead you to break it. Maybe in a future life when you're the abbot or something. So number 18. Last and most. Does that make sense? Not least. most serious one, actually. Sen means what?
Bodhicitta.
Sen means mind, stands here for Sankhya, which is Bodhicitta. Sen means Bodhicitta. Tong means to give it up. To give it up. Which of the two types do you think they're talking about? Nope. It's a bodhicitta is in the form of a prayer or a wish. Okay? It's the original intention of wanting to reach enlightenment to help all sentient beings. It's that frame of mind. It's giving up that frame of mind. Yeah?
The aspiring mind for oneself or the aspiring mind for others?
It aspires that oneself should reach it for others. If you were here, you would know. We had that already. Okay. Jetsam Kapa mentions, and I'm glad because I didn't know. This is the one vow that came from the Sutra on Skillful Means, remember? There were 13 from the Sutra of the Essence of Space, and there was only one vow from the Sutra of Skillful Means. This is the one. He's a real logician. Jetsam Kapa. He says, you know, when you think about it, you can only commit this one for 1 second. Why?
Because you're not a bodhisattva.
You're not a bodhisattva the next moment. You break it the first moment that you give it up, then the next minute you're not a bodhisattva anymore to give it up.
What does it mean to give it up?
As if I ask me that. To reject the idea of the bodhisattva ideal, to say I will no longer work for the I will no longer work for the benefit of all. I do not want to become enlightened. For the sake. I give up.
How is that different than the prior vow of rejecting Mahayana, which is?
He talks about it.
You know, it says giving up either of the two aspects of the bodhisattva.
That one is
path.
Given up by saying that it, in one case by saying that the Buddha didn't teach it. And in the other case, by rejecting all the ideas of it. And this is just by personally deciding that you're not going to do it anymore. You had it, and you decided you're not going to do it. Because you have to have it when you take the vows, right? Upon taking the vows, one of the conditions is you have to have some wimpy form of the desire to become a Buddha to help all other beings. Otherwise, it actually doesn't form anyway. This and one other vow are the two most serious. Well, which is the other one?
Wrong view.
Yeah, wrong view. These two do not require certain attitudes to be present in your mind for you to break the root vow. All the other 16, you have to have four other attitudes in your mind at the time that you break the vow. In the next class, he's going to be all wholly devoted to those four attitudes because it's a big subject. There's four really crummy, lousy attitudes that you have to have, and they're very hard to have all at once, which is good for us. To break a root vow, you have to have all four of those really extraordinarily evil thoughts in your mind, except for this one and the wrong views. Those two are so destructive that they don't require any other attitude in your mind when you have them. And again, two things. Two things I like to say experientially, right? By now, you should be keeping the first nine, and you should be enjoying seeing some kind of results from it. And if you're not working on it, you probably won't work on it later. You know, if you don't work on it the first few days after you first hear them, the odds of you working on it later are pretty small. You know, you should already be experimenting with these at the office, you know, and checking yourself every day. And if you're not doing it now, I promise you, you won't be doing it 6 months from now or 8 months from now. This is the time. Strike while the iron is hot. While your mind is on it, get into the habit of searching your heart every day to see if you did them. You know, if you're like me and you don't have time to count all 18 every day, frankly, keep it in a little book and rotate. Do three today, do three the next day, do three the next. But start now. If you don't start this week, I'm pretty sure you won't do it. And then the next time you hear they have a bodhisattva vow class, you'll say, I heard it already, I know it all. You know, and you'll miss out the chance. And then your life should already I've noticed a few people did because they came to me and we had some interesting conversations. So it's extraordinary. If you try it, just try it. Just try it tomorrow. I mean, start tomorrow. You have a list. Start. You have in the reading now all 18. So make a Xerox, keep it with you, look at it every day, check off the ones you already reviewed, and start keeping it now. And you'll already get some things will start to change immediately. It's very fantastic. The virtue is incredible, and things start to change in your life immediately. And if you don't do it now, you won't do it later, I promise you. You won't have time. And then you'll get chepto. Chepto means jaded. You'll get to the point where you say, I heard all that before. It's very dangerous to hear something once, because the second time you're not interested. Because you learned it already. So start now. Start reviewing them. And then help each other. Help me. You know, you see this person breaking it, say something. And I had the pleasure someday to... Somebody today corrected me properly. And I was a student, and I was quite happy. I said, now, this is a benefit, you know. So correct each other in a good way. You're required to correct each other at a certain point, but it has to be with love and happy, and they say, in a happy mood. It has to be done in a good mood. So help each other. Let's all help each other keep them. And then we'll have a really good result. Yeah?
I have a two-part question on the subject of doing these every day in the tundra. Can you comment on the quality of the translation that most of us have in English of the long version that has all these vows in it, number one? Is that pretty decent for those of us who just take vows? And number two, might there be a better translation floating around that some American monk who shall remain unnamed might not have published yet?
I have two answers. One is, Geshe Tsewan Sangyu's commentary, which you all have in your hands now, is to me the thing that you should carry around. I don't think the thing that Tundu, some of the vows are missing in there. Shakya Ninyen doesn't mention striking another person. So I would carry
tundra
around this thing with you.
In the Tundra proper, not in the
yeah, it doesn't mention it in the Tundu. It's not mentioned in the Tundu. Okay. So I would say that's the first thing. That's the first answer. I gave you the most precious one I can think of. Khyabje Pavonka was the one who turned us on to that. In two places in his writings, he says, I'm not going to write anything about the vows because Geshe Tsewan Sangyu did it perfectly. You know, go get that book. You got the book. That's the first translation of that book. So keep it. And then my dream is that somebody, a talented person in this class, like Mr. Brady or somebody, makes a little card that we can carry around with us with all the vows on it. Like very short, like a little folded thing that you keep in your wallet. You know, like just two business cards glued together, and it has all the 64 vows on it, and maybe a little check box next to it.
You know, post it.
Yeah,
zero.
You could have a date. This is for the week of so and so, and you have 50 of them at home. You carry them around. Atisha did that. Don't think it's silly. You see his picture of Atisha, he's always got this stupa. He carried around an image of the Buddha. And it's well known fact that when he was riding around on his horse, people hated to ride with him because every time he had a bad thought, he would get off the horse, put the Buddha down, and do his confessions right there on the spot. And all his disciples are standing around waiting for him, you know. But he was the one who was intelligent enough to go confess it immediately. I think that'd be cool. I think that'd be a great service. We could make something like that. And then you just carry it around you and you check it every day, at least once. You know? I think it'd be really great. Yeah.
I have a question for you. You talked about reviewing each one of these every day. And, you know, we just got to say that it's very difficult to break something. It's very difficult to, yeah, you know, praising yourself and criticizing others. I mean, on the face of it, yeah, we all do that every day. But yeah, are you saying then take what's written here and extrapolate it into what?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
a lot of these things,
yeah,
you would not break. So.
It's that concentric circle thing. Did we do that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Here you go. And then we'll stop. Okay. This is how one of my lamas explained monk's morality to me one time. This is, he says, your morality has to be like concentric circles. This is looking at a lady on the street. This is being alone with a lady in a room. This is sitting on a couch with a lady. This is sitting on a bed with a lady. This is breaking your vows with a lady, you know. But he said, if you stay out here, you'll never get to here, you know. So that the concept of keeping your bodhisattva vows is very similar. You know, if you never praise yourself and criticize others for any bad motivation, you'll never get to that ultimate one where the other person's a Mahayana practitioner and you're a Mahayana practitioner and you're accusing them of some bad motivation that you have no idea whether they have or not. And so if you never... What I say and what I found is when you review your bodhisattva vows, when you get to the first one, say, okay, look, I didn't criticize Chogyam Trungpa today. Okay. No, it's a good example. It's a very good example. We don't know. We don't know what his motivation was. So, but I did, you know, talk good about myself and criticize the other merchandiser. Yeah. I mean, we do, you know. But if you never break, it's a very, very important for keeping your vows. Remember the. We'll draw it on the in. That'll be embossed as a what do you call it? A letter mark.
Watermark.
Okay, Mr. Brady. Concentric circles in the background. And if you never praise yourself and put down someone else, you're never going to do it in the most serious context of possibly creating a schism among people who are all supposed to be out to save all sentient beings. One more question, Mary. Really.
Okay. If you had, if someone had engaged in this behavior before checking.
Yeah, by the way, you have to have the vows to break them. It may seem obvious, but I have to say that. You have to have the vows to break them.
So the rule does not apply that if you broke these, what would be vows before, that you can't go to this first...
Bodhisattva Bhumi?
Yes.
Jetsun Kapa says that's correct. I don't remember if that's exact the context, but he does say... He describes all the horrible things that happen if you break the vows, and then he says, therefore, before you take them, you better examine yourself well. You know, think about it carefully before you take them. Which would imply that. It is true that the more you know, the worse it is. Okay? With morality. Better not to know in some cases, you know. Once you know, it's much worse if you break it.